Hello and welcome to the latest in the series of the Southwest Faculty for Advancing Practice podcast. In this episode, we'll be exploring advanced practice from a musculoskeletal perspective. My name is Simon Ingram. I'm a musculoskeletal consultant physiotherapist in Somerset, but also the supervision and assessment lead for musculoskeletal health and physiotherapy within the Southwest Advanced Practice Faculty. I'd like to introduce my guests. So firstly, Susie Durrell.
Hello, I'm Susie Durrell. I'm consultant physiotherapist in Gloucestershire, and I'm the integrated care board lead around advanced practice for Gloucestershire.
Thanks, Susie. Thanks for joining us. And Nick?
Hi, Simon. Thank you for inviting me. So my name is Nick Sullivan. I'm Health Education England, now NHS England's Workforce Transformation Education team since our merger on the 1st of April. I'm our regional faculty lead for advancing practice for the London region. I've also, on behalf of our national team, the Centre for Advancing Practice, been project managing the development of our credential specification for musculoskeletal conditions. So this is the capability and curriculum framework for advanced clinical practice in musculoskeletal care.
Brilliant. Thank you. And we'll look to delve into that in just a bit. So firstly, just to set the scene a little bit, what do we see kind of the background to advanced practice within musculoskeletal conditions?
Well, the reason it's been a focus for us in development of this framework, Simon, is really the volume of patients for whom musculoskeletal conditions are an issue in the UK. So we look at the data, population health metrics. The data we have available suggests about 20 million people in the UK are living with some form of musculoskeletal condition. They very rarely exist in a silo. So we're looking at a sector of the population who typically have a number of concurrent comorbidities. So alongside musculoskeletal conditions, knock-on effect of more sedentary lifestyles, impact on quality of life, we're often seeing comorbidities, various lifestyle-related health conditions are type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, depression, mental health issues. And the subsequent knock-on effect on quality of life and other population health metrics we're seeing, we were looking at ONS data from 2019 that showed the number of working days lost as a result, direct result of musculoskeletal conditions, I think in the region of 24 million within that 1 year. So the impact on the population of musculoskeletal conditions is huge.
And I think that resonates well with our experiences on the ground, particularly in the NHS delivery services, where our patients are presenting with long-term, complex conditions, indeed many comorbidities, but also lifestyle factors and the mix of physical and mental health issues that are impacting them, their ability to live well and work well through their life.
Yeah, thank you. So just taking an advanced practice look at that. So historically, can you tell us a little bit more about how advanced practice in the field of musculoskeletal health has developed?
So I was lucky enough to be one of the earlier pioneers of some extended roles, as we called them at that stage. Physiotherapists particularly going into roles either supporting rheumatology or orthopaedic secondary care pathways was where some of the original innovation began. And of course, many years ago, we used terminology around the extended role, and then people were often described as extended scope practitioners. We were there to try to support navigation of patients, but assessing patients presenting often to a higher specialist service and finding that significant benefit could be gained from seeing a physiotherapist within that team. And redirecting a patient's care away from secondary specialist services.
And just moving forward then, Nick, do we see now much more of a diversity in the advanced practice roles within MSK?
We're beginning to, Simon. I think it is a sector of the advanced practice community that has grown largely in a silo. Advanced practice is not new. We can trace origins of advanced clinical practice roles to nursing in the United States, I think in the 70s and 80s. There have been a variety of advanced practice roles across different professional groups and areas of specialism for an awfully long time. As Susie said, within the musculoskeletal community, very much within the physiotherapy community, initially we have quite a lot of evidence, quite a lot of research that demonstrated the impact they have on clinical pathways, the safety, the efficacy of those roles, which is why those extended scope roles have been adopted into the mainstream of physiotherapy practice. We are starting to see similar advanced level roles in other professional groups. So we have MSK podiatrists, osteopaths working within NHS services, again, working at a similar level of practice. The challenge we've had, and this is where development of those roles in the musculoskeletal community has happened very much in a silo to other professional groups, is how those roles have been defined. We haven't seen much standardization either across professional groups or even within professional groups as to exactly what those roles involve, how we really articulate the capabilities across the four pillars of advanced practice, being clinical practice, leadership and management, education, research, how we articulate the value of those four pillars to the MSK sphere of practice, but also how we standardize the education and training, develop those advanced level capabilities across the four pillars, across our multi-professional groups working in the MSK field.
And I'd support that it's this standardization and real ability to narrate and consider the capabilities that we're able to take people through a pathway of a more formal underpinning with their education that might support what we want, which is safely governed and safely assured practitioners working at the highest possible level within their services. And again, across the broader sort of multi-professional team, with making a real difference to patient service delivery.
So just linking that back to the start, Nick, where you talked about the impact of MSK conditions on population health, is it fair to say then there's huge potential for the impact of advanced practice across England?
Very much so. And again, I think as Susie has said, given the history of advanced practice roles or roles we can associate with advanced level practice, at least in some of the clinical pillars in MSK groups of the workforce, we have evidence and demonstrated that impact of those roles. What we haven't had is a standardized approach to the education and training of that sector of the workforce. And we've got such a focus on advanced clinical practice across multi-professional groups at the moment. It is a key workforce strategy within to try and meet the ambitions of the NHS long-term plan, the NHS people plan. There's a real opportunity to grow that sector of the workforce to really meet those expectations of getting the right care earlier in patient pathways, having our clinicians with the ability to undertake the right assessment, diagnosis, triage, management planning, with the right capabilities to undertake that earlier in the pathway to maximize the care for our patients, which in turn will have a significant impact on a lot of the other metrics we're trying to influence at the moment.
And of course, we have lots of talented clinicians who are highly trained, and historically there may have been an overfocus on the clinical pillars and capabilities. And what we're really looking for is people with the appropriate training and ability to work to really drive innovation and change and improvement within their role.
I think that's key, Susie, and that's a big differentiator between advanced practice roles and other senior specialist and even expert level roles. We're looking to drive service transformation, service improvement, service change, and we need that to be led by the clinician to understand their services. There's a common misconception when we talk about the four pillars that they're four entirely discrete, separate pillars, and only the clinical pillar directly impacts the care we deliver to our patients. If we're really embedding the capabilities and the spirit of the four pillar capabilities within our clinical practice, we're looking to grow a sector of the workforce who have the leadership, the research skills to evaluate their services, to drive service change, to help educate and upskill the wider workforce within their teams. If they are only building their clinical capabilities within the clinical pillar, the only patients who will ever benefit from their expertise are the individual patients they themselves as a practitioner can see. By working across the four pillars, they improve the quality of care for all patients who come through their service, irrespective of who within their service they see.
Yeah, brilliant, Nick. I think it is the potential across the pathways and systems, isn't it, that you're alluding to there, you know, beyond, like you say, just the clinical pillar. So Nick, in the introduction, you alluded to the musculoskeletal credential that's been developed by the Centre for Advancing Practice. Could you just tell us a little bit about the background as to why that was developed and maybe a bit about what a credential is?
Sure. Well, the Centre for Advanced Practice has been looking at development of a number of specialist credential specifications. Now, when we use the word credential, it can be used in different ways by different groups to mean different things. We're not using credential as a verb to be credentialed in the context of regulation or registration of individual practitioners. We're using it as a noun. So we're talking about a single assessed unit of learning. So it's a framework of capabilities, curriculum framework against which education providers can build speciality advanced level practice programs. As an organization, we have commissioned and funded advanced practice training for quite a few years now. We're currently taking through a national accreditation process a lot of our existing ACP master's programs delivered by education providers across the country. Historically, they have all been generalist programs that can, if they're diligently implemented and individuals work with their education provider and their employer to shape the heavily workplace-based element of those programs, they can be shaped to individuals' areas of specialism, but their core are the core generalist capabilities as outlined in the 2017 multi-professional framework. For some areas of practice, they've been more fit for purpose than others. For others, it's been very much felt that some of that generic core content doesn't always have transferability and applicability to their niche areas of practice, and there are specific knowledge, skills, and attributes needed for certain areas of specialism that may not be covered by the generalist programs. So we have been looking to develop a number of credential specifications that aim to articulate those speciality capabilities, still very much within the spirit of the multi-professional framework, but really seen through the lens of a particular sector of the workforce and their area of specialism. Now, the MSK credential specification is one we've been working on for a few years now. So there's been a little bit of a background here. We've been working with our partnership group, the UK MSK Partnership Group, who are a multi-professional expert, subject matter expert group of musculoskeletal clinicians and leaders, who initially back in 2019 undertook a piece of research, a piece of work looking at the IFOMP standards. So these are the International Federation of Orthopaedic and Manipulative Physical Therapists. This is an international organization who sets standards for largely physical therapy education programs in the musculoskeletal sphere. And the UK MSK Partnership Group undertook a piece of work reviewing those IFOMP standards to try and articulate them for UK-specific advanced level practice. Off the back of that piece of work, they recently published the UK MSK Advanced Practice Standards, which are currently available on the ARMA website. So that's the Arthritis Research and Musculoskeletal Alliance. Now, the UK MSK AP standards articulate more specifically the minimum standards expected with regards to knowledge, skills, and attributes of those working at an advanced level of practice in the musculoskeletal field. What we have then done is built on those AP standards with our framework to develop the governance, the structure, and articulate the specific learning outcomes and underpinning capabilities expected of education providers in England to really prepare AP trainees to meet the wider holistic health and social care needs of the MSK population in England.
I'd love to thank and comment about the strength of this from the expertise, and the broad co-production is really a strength of this piece of work.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks, Susie. And I think, so Nick, just to clarify then, so a credential really is something that's more for an education provider to maybe take and work with, as opposed to maybe a clinician on the ground working in MSK.
Very much so. So the credential specification is really a framework for education providers to build full advanced level practice educational programs geared towards the musculoskeletal community and the specific learning outcomes and capabilities required of that sector of the workforce. So it's really the framework for development of a full master's level program of study.
Brilliant. And certainly from my regional role, I think discussing with trainees, I think you're right, you touched upon earlier about the learning needs of the individual. I think that's important context to consider, because actually the generalist kind of type skills, you know, knowledge, skills and attributes you alluded to, for some in the role they work in. So we've got MSK clinicians working in emergency departments and they feel they want that broad systems kind of approach. Whereas we do have people working within very niche areas within MSK, maybe working in hand units and things like that. And they felt that maybe the programs weren't offering the richness of MSK that they really wanted. And so I think, you know, that sounds like this has been developed really much on the feedback from the ground, from those that have, you know, had experience from the education programs to date.
It has, very much so. And again, reflecting on the data of the trainees we currently support. So if I use as an example my London region, last year we supported just under 1,000 advanced practitioner trainees across all areas of specialism, professional groups. That's both new and continuing trainees, just under 1,000. We had quite a significant number of those are physiotherapists currently on our funded and supported programs. Almost all of them are from areas of practice such as critical care, urgent emergency care, frailty, respiratory care, where the core content of our generalist ACP programs do have transferability. They do have currency to their practice. Despite the MSK workforce being a large percentage of the advanced practice population currently, of those just under 1,000 trainees we supported last year, the number of MSK physios was 2. So there's clearly something that isn't quite working with regards to the current education provision, our current funded, supported offers for those individuals. Now, that isn't to say training isn't going on. There are existing musculoskeletal master's level programs, but because there is this degree of variation, they're not currently recognized within this sphere. They're not ones who can currently accredit, recognize, and support financially and with workplace supervision support for employers. It's a sector of the workforce that just isn't receiving the support others are. So there is an element of inequity of access to opportunity for funded training places.
As someone who has supported individuals on a generic pathway and now evolving MSK advanced practice pathways, I think part of this is the transition where we had the benefit of some highly specialized, very appropriate musculoskeletal masters in the MSK field, but it's helping people to understand the other capabilities and the change around this level of practice. And as Simon said, the sort of broadening skill set. But again, the reliance on effective supervision in practice and the tripartite approach where the employer, the service delivery, the workforce plan is all extremely key under good supervision is something that I think is taking a little time in the conversations and in the change and the transition currently.
I agree, Susie. It's very much a culture change. So it is worth noting that our work in this space, Simon, is very much around workforce transformation. So the funding support offers we all have in region for our ACP trainees, it isn't a CPD fund, it's a workforce transformation fund for employers, very much linked to their workforce plans and growth of the advanced practice workforce. We're funding a growth in the workforce rather than CPD needs of individuals.
Brilliant. And Nick, we talked earlier about the, I guess, the broad nature of MSK and where we see MSK advanced practitioners sitting of multiple steps across the pathway from primary care right through to secondary care. Is the credential going to be able to encompass all of those roles, or are we going to look at something that focuses on maybe the core aspects of MSK advanced practice?
It is the core. So pragmatically, in terms of how much we can cover in one credential, we can't have a dozen bespoke MSK-focused credential specifications. Our whole credential program become quite unwieldy if we attempted to do so. So we have gone for high volume, high impact. It articulates the core transferable MSK skills that would be expected in any area of MSK practice. Now, of course, there will be discrete bespoke capabilities and competencies required for different areas of specialism. It would be unrealistic to assume an MSK practitioner in primary care who may need a breadth of knowledge around general medicine, triage, diagnosis, exclusion of non-MSK pathology, their skill set may be quite different to a highly specialized advanced practitioner working in a secondary care clinic whose role is around understanding triage pathways, surgical listing, the nuances of an area of specialism. That won't be covered within a generalist MSK program, but the core skills of understanding assessment, diagnosis, management planning within the context of wider population health needs and adopting a patient-centered approach to embedding the four pillars of practice within their clinical practice would have transferability and currency to all of those bespoke areas.
And just in support of that, I think we've seen evidence in practice of those principles being applied. But of course, the level of advanced practice pathway is that constant criticality and inquisitiveness, some of which we are very aware that there are attributes at either interview or at entrance to university that need to be shown by individuals for them to demonstrate the potential to work to their highest in these roles.
It's a really interesting point, Susie, and I completely agree. One of the key elements of advanced practice level education is not spoon feeding the competencies required to do a job. It's building in the critical thinking, the analysis, the metacognition skills an individual needs to deal with uncertainty, to deal with risk in their practice, to be reflective, to continue their own professional development in the future and to have the skill set to do so.
And I think, again, just coming back to that workforce transformation, we're seeing that the need for more flexible workforce, the ability for people to maybe work now in more portfolio roles as we start to take a system approach to care. We're seeing that with the formations of integrated care systems. So I think you're right. I think people having those transferable skills that you've alluded to are going to be really integral to, you know, our workforce development moving forwards, where we know there's only a finite resource of people. So Nick, I'm aware that the focus when we're developing the MSK credential was to making something that was contemporary for MSK, encompassed the key aspects that underpin the role. Could you tell us a little bit more about the content?
Sure. Well, the main focus outside of the implementation and the governance sections and outlining expectations of education providers around delivery, expectation of employers with regard to workplace-based supervision, that the core of the document are the learning outcomes and the MSK-specific underpinning capabilities expected of education programs. Now, like I said, we haven't built this from scratch. We've built on the content of the UK MSK AP standards. We've articulated that in a language that draws back to the multi-professional framework for advanced practice and current national NHS workforce transformation priorities. So we've outlined those against five domains. So the first being person-centered care, where we've tried to articulate MSK-specific knowledge, skills, and attributes and the capabilities needed to manage the wider population health and social care needs of the NHS population. The second is the domain of assessment, investigations, and diagnosis. So this is articulating the advanced level practice capabilities individuals need to assess, triage, diagnose, manage on referrals, manage appropriate use of diagnostic investigations, dealing with medical complexity and uncertainty and risk that one sees within an advanced level of practice. So this goes above and beyond standard MSK practice within this field. The third is prevention, management planning and intervention, which similarly is about dealing with complexity, uncertainty, risk, and working at master's level with the clinical reasoning associated with those facets of the care we deliver to patients. And the last two are leadership, service development and education, and research, which again, rather than approach from the generalist way they are in the multi-professional framework, we've articulated how to embed leadership, research and education skills within one's MSK practice.
Brilliant. And Susie, what were your reflections on the MSK credential?
I think as a supervisor on the ground, there will be really good reflection that the domain C around prevention, condition management and intervention remains really coherent with significant capabilities that we want so that clinicians don't become overly reliant on concern around reliance on over-diagnostic investigations, but actually really use their skills and develop their skills with undifferentiated conditions where actually primary management and prevention may be the best answer with a patient-centered approach.
Yeah, and I think a couple of things stand out to me. One is that the capabilities here very much could be applicable across a multi-professional workforce. I think looking at obviously physiotherapists are key players in the MSK space, but it's not exclusive to a physiotherapist. And I think these capabilities are transferable. And the other thing is, as alluded to, is I think that it's quite a contemporary. It considers the emphasis around prevention, as you say, the wider determinants of health are acknowledged, and also behavior change and recognizing that a lot of the MSK conditions we see are associated with comorbidities that are potentially preventative in nature. So hopefully it'll be something that's well received by education providers, but also, you know, by those trainees that embark on the program. So Nick, what are the next steps with regards to the MSK credential?
So it's currently going through its final draft development. So it's going out to independent reviewers. We've got quite a robust process. We take all of our draft credential specifications through that involves public feedback, which we have now had for the credential specification, a draft that goes out to independent reviewers who provide feedback, and then a final draft goes to our Education Assurance Group, our national team, for scrutiny, ratification, and eventual publication once we've managed with any conditions or particular feedback we have to incorporate into our final version. Now, that process, to make it robust and to have the level of quality assurance we want in that process, it isn't a fast process. So we anticipate there may be another couple of months in that development process. We anticipate probably the middle to the second half of this year, we will have a published document ready for education providers to start to review.
Fantastic. And I think certainly from our region's perspective, there seems to be quite a lot of interest amongst education providers. Is that fair to say?
Very much so. So again, this is quite a heterogeneous sector of the education sector, that there is a lot of musculoskeletal education provision already out there across England, across the UK. There isn't a huge amount of standardization of curriculum within that space. I think we have a lot of education providers very keen to see what comes forwards, how their existing programs may align. And equally, we have a number of providers of generalist ACP programs looking to grow the breadth of the speciality programs they develop. So we're seeing both existing providers of MSK master's programs looking to align to advanced level practice education, and providers of generalist programs looking to develop specialisms as pathways within their programs too.
Brilliant. Sounds very exciting. So I noticed the credential, there's been a deliberate focus here around work-based learning and supervision. Could you just explain a little bit more why there's such a strong emphasis within this MSK credential?
Well, these are academic programs because we want that quality assurance, that scrutiny, that oversight, that assessment to ensure we do have strong standardization of standards of education and training. But these are very practical skills people are learning. They are things that need to be tested in the workplace. People need to learn in the workplace. It needs to have that applicability, that transferability of learning. So workplace-based learning and assessment in the workplace and the clinical environment is integral to all our advanced practice programs, not specific to MSK, but it's absolutely something that must be embedded. Workplace-based learning can't be a tokenistic element of these master's programs. It must be front and center of delivering the program itself and of demonstrating the capabilities in practice. So ensuring not just the education providers have quality assurance of the learning outcomes and capabilities of their taught modules, but ensuring their support for the employers for that practice-based learning and assessment in the workplace is absolutely key to the governance, the quality assurance of the delivery of these credential specifications.
And in support, again, just as an educational supervisor over many years, where we have moved through the descriptors and high clinical roles and now the advanced practice piece, I'm delighted to see the importance that's put upon all of the advanced practice roles around the educational supervision with minimum standards that are available for us to work towards. And watching people over time on the long courses, for example, this being likely to be about a 3-year pathway with an overarching supervisor, I hope will show great success and really support the health and well-being of the individual, as well as supporting their development and being able to make some of this transformational change over time. But in addition, supporting educational supervisors to be fit for purpose and to be really, really knowledgeable in this type of framework and delivery is going to be a key factor too.
Absolutely. I think the other thing is it's a lever to raise the profile of supervision. And I think we've seen it in regions sometimes where there's an emphasis and a real kind of motivation to deliver advanced practice and use it as a way to transform care that's delivered. But sometimes the thought process around the supervision that's going to underpin the development of those roles comes as a secondary kind of thought. So I think it's really important that, you know, supervision is thought about right from the start when we're looking to develop these roles. Susie, have you come across that too?
Yeah, I think we need to be realistic that we're in an unprecedented circumstance in many services with a dearth in our workforce. And we're trying to make sure that we have well-governed or safely governed supervision. And I think it's about acknowledging the pressures. But this is where the workforce planning transformational piece comes in. Because if we underestimate the need of the supervision, we may have individuals who are not going to succeed on these pathways or indeed are overwhelmed. And in fact, that would be very short-term thinking. We need to have some long-term thinking about this. So again, just to reinforce, as part of the workforce planning, we really need to think about the educational supervision, but not in silos. Perhaps, again, having some really creative, really innovative ways of thinking about supervision across the multi-professional teams, the multi-professional patient pathways.
And just to add there, sorry, I know there's some super exciting stuff coming out from the supervision assessment leads to help support and develop supervision within systems and providers. So watch this space on that.
I think these are some really valid points, Simon. I don't think we can underestimate the pressure on clinical services now. We've had an unprecedented 3 years. The push on waiting lists, staff recruitment and retention, pressures on the workforce, sickness absences has never been higher in the NHS. So whilst we have the aspirations to grow our workforce, to grow our advanced practice workforce, the on-the-ground realities for teams like yours, Susie, of both releasing staff for training and actually releasing supervisors to undertake that workplace-based learning is incredibly difficult. So anything we can do to support at regional level, at ICS level, that networking of supervisors to support services in delivering that high-quality, high standards of educational supervision, but also through this standardization of education that does attract extra training, does attract extra support, financial and resource support to organizations in order to allow you to deliver that training for your staff, hopefully has the potential to be a game changer.
Brilliant. So, I echo that. And I think the other bit that comes back to what we said at the start about the advanced practice role being more than just a clinical facing role is that our future advanced practice workforce will play a key part in our, you know, supervision infrastructure, embedding research, be it through clinical academic type roles, or just driving leadership at system level. So I think, this is also coming back to remind ourselves of, you know, why people go on these programs is not purely for the clinical aspect. So if you're someone who's looking to develop the MSK advanced practice workforce, where do you think, what would be your next steps? What would be your advice?
So in my integrated care board lead role, it's become clear that historically we've not been good at workforce planning. So initially, it's really important that the ICBs, but also operational and clinical leaders, really consider the patient population and the patient service delivery needs and look at what their workforce plan might need and how many advanced practitioner roles that are clearly defined, so that we've got some clarity about the expectations on the delivery of these roles, but not underestimating the value of other clinical roles across career progression within and across the MDT as well.
I think that's a really interesting and valid point, Susie. So we often have our stakeholders come to us in region because we have a funding offer, an opportunity for advanced practitioners, come to us with demand for trainees for their area of the workforce. Now, we almost need to encourage individuals to sometimes take a step backwards and start thinking before you start to plan your advanced practice workforce. Like you say, Susie, it's an answer. It's a workforce solution. It isn't the only one. We need to almost take a step back and look at what are your population health needs? Who are the patients coming through your service? What knowledge, skills, attributes, capabilities are needed in your staff to deliver the outcomes those patients need? And that's where a strong, robust workforce plan comes in to determine what levels of practice or what level of seniority are needed across your team to deliver on the outcomes your patients expect of your services. Some of those will be advanced practitioners, not all of them will be, but it's only off the back of a robust workforce plan that can really identify that the genuine need, the genuine demand for advanced practitioners.
So if I was looking to support a member of our team or develop our local workforce in regards to the MSK credential, Nick, what things would I need to consider to the suitability of the individual to go down that route?
Well, the individuals themselves, again, we are looking at quite an experienced senior sector of the workforce who have the prior experience to take on this new breadth of capabilities, responsibilities, all the facets that we associate with advanced level practice of working at master's level, dealing with uncertainty, having the knowledge and expertise to work across the four pillars. Now, the first thing we would expect of anyone accessing these programs, given our focus is on quality assurance of the advanced level practice elements of their training, we are not there to vet their fitness to practice as healthcare professionals. These must be statutory regulated healthcare professionals registered with a statutory regulator within the UK with current registration. That's obviously an essential criteria. another, given that our support of individuals on programs is linked to organizational workforce plans, is to ensure they do have their employers' support. This is a very practice-based training we're looking to support individuals on, and that requires employer support. It requires a strong, robust workforce plan to ensure there is an advanced practice role for the individual on completion of training, and also to ensure there's a plan for, as you've touched on, Susie, the robust workplace-based educational supervision that'll be required just to maximize their chance of success on the program.
And the key people that can often be helpful in this process are our advanced practice leads within each provider or system. Susie, do you want to explain your role in that?
Yeah, so I've been doing this role for a year and I'm in the ICB lead position. However, linking with provider and provider education leads has been so valuable. We're beginning to create a single narrative across Gloucestershire so that if either individuals or leaders or commissioners approach us regarding this type of role, we have a similar conversation and are similarly able to direct people to appropriate resources and information from Centre for Advancing Practice and also Southwest faculty, which has been invaluable. We now recognise there have been a significant number of missed opportunities for potential funding over many years. So hopefully we're beginning to see the benefits of some of this additional advanced practice leadership support. So if anybody is interested and hasn't reached out locally or to their system or indeed to the Southwest faculty resources, I would hugely advocate that. So we're often able to start with trying to really thrash out what the advanced practice defined role would deliver, what the added value would be, and trying to support people within their own provider and system, support them with their workforce planning piece. But also, we've got so many resources now that we can share, particularly across region, but maybe nationally, and make connections so that people don't all need to reinvent the wheel.
I have to say, Susie, your role in the Southwest sounds absolutely fantastic. And what we hope to see in the future is every ICS across the country has a Susie, someone doing your type of role at ICS level to support that workforce planning. It's an aspiration. We're not quite there yet. So what I would say, Simon, to an audience, if we have individual clinicians, practitioners listening to your podcast, interested in these opportunities, unsure of the links within their own regions, in the first instance, I would suggest seeking out an advanced practice lead within your own organization, whether that's an acute trust, community trust, or primary care training hub. If you're within that sector of the workforce, we'll be able to direct you to the various funding opportunities. If you don't, then another port of call might be your regional advanced practice faculty. So again, the contact details for all seven of our teams are on our national teams website. If people did want to see that, again, everything we've spoken about with regards to development of the credentials, details of the credentials when they're published, details of the regional faculties and their contact details, are all on the regional faculty section of the website. Address is advanced-practice. That's hyphen, not underscore, practice with a C, not an S. advanced-practice.hee.nhs.uk. So if you're unsure how to find your Susie in your region, our website might be another first port of call, a bit of extra information and resources.
Brilliant, really useful. And I think, yeah, certainly from the Southwest Advanced Practice faculty, it's always been about trying to put together an infrastructure that, you know, offers development, but also sustainability for advanced practice. And I think the direction of travel has been that we want people to understand advanced practice first. So there's a little bit around that, but also then be able to identify the routes for development, access resources, you say, Nick, from funding routes, and hopefully in some way in the future that advanced practice is very much governed and managed at system level, and that would be our aspiration, I think.
Absolutely, could not agree more, Simon. And again, I think with this standardization of education provision, it opens doors, it helps standardize training for the workforce, it provides more quality assurance for employers, for commissioners, and for the public, who deserve to expect that if they see someone work at advanced level of practice, that that has currency, it has standardization, whether you're seeing advanced practice physio, osteopath, podiatrist, or whether it's within the MSK area of specialism or another, and to provide that standardization, that quality assurance has benefits outside of just the development of the individuals themselves.
So Nick, if I was an education provider looking to deliver the MSK credential, what would that mean to me?
But we've intentionally kept the capability and curriculum framework flexible to allow novel and innovative methods of delivery by education providers. So whilst we've been very robust on the governance, the core learning outcomes and capabilities, there is some flexibility in the method of delivery by education providers, as long as those essential criteria are met. So that could be via the traditional master's level program study route. Equally, a lot of education providers may choose to access the apprenticeship levy for funding and development of apprenticeship pathways that nevertheless deliver the same learning outcomes and embedded capabilities. It's also important to note that this, of course, is a framework for development of prospective training programs for people undertaking a new pathway of development and learning. It isn't a framework for the retrospective recognition of the existing advanced practice workforce. Where there is that interest in seeking retrospective recognition, then we do have alternative pathways such as our supported e-portfolio route to recognition.
So it sounds like MSK really has a seat at the table. It sounds now as seen on a national level within policy, along other long-term conditions, that we really are now able to kind of put a focus on developing the workforce to meet our local population needs. Just as we draw to a close, Susie, was there anything more you'd like to add?
Just to thank everybody's expertise that's been involved in this, but to really say how I hope on the ground this will hugely support career progression for MSK advanced practitioners.
And Nick?
Yes, I guess watch this space, really. So I would suggest individuals do keep an eye on our website that I alluded to earlier. We are expecting, when the credential specification is finally published, that will be the landing page on which to find it. We are undertaking concurrent work with education providers to scope demand, potential delivery and capacity amongst our education providers to deliver a recognised and accredited to be their first MSK advanced practice pathway.
Thank you. Exciting times ahead. Many thanks, Nick and Susie, for your time, and the listeners, we hope you've enjoyed today's podcast. Take care. Thank you very much.